Oh my God, they don't know Jean's here. They need us. I felt like they need still here.
Welcome to Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. I'm your host, Shuang Esther Shan. In an era when retail closures dominate headlines, one denim brand is still here. And they're thriving.
We shipped to them and they sold out within a week and a half.
With only $20,000 and a single rack of hand-painted jeans, husband and wife founders Sonia and Maurice Mosseri launched Still Here, a vintage-inspired denim label that has been turning heads and profits in New York and beyond.
So about 4 weeks from now, we'll have our third store.
And third baby, same due date.
Sonia and Maurice are here to share how they've won over fashion editors and bootstrapped Still Here to a multi-million dollar brand. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. We're excited to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Very, very excited to chat with you both. Sonia, why don't we start with you? There has been so many different denim labels on the market, but you felt something was missing. What inspired you to start this line?
So my father was born in Egypt and came to America in the 60s. His family was prosecuted out of Egypt and had to leave everything behind. They came to New York with practically no money, and his parents gave him a couple dollars and said, go buy jeans for school and size up. They're going to have to last you a long time. And he bought this incredible pair of Levi's that he actually wore throughout all of his schooling. And so eventually, years later, when he had kids, he gave them to me as a memento of his childhood. And of course, they meant the world to me. I still have them. They have markings of, you know, ink stains and acid stains from his chem class and patches that, you know, my grandmother sewed on for him. So much memory was captured in this pair, and it definitely sparked an incredible inspiration and journey for me in my career. I had a dual career kind of coming out of college of wanting to be in fashion, but hating the industry and also loving fine art and, you know, about to embark on a master's program in fine art. And I decided to just start taking my vintage jean collection, which I had gathered over the years, and start painting on them. And it was an interesting time on Instagram where, you know, you could get a lot of traction online on Instagram. And so I, you know, these jeans were getting a lot of exciting, just notable people wanting them. And there was a lot of excitement around the product. So as a New Yorker, my fingers were on the pulse of fashion. And I was, you know, a young consumer in my 20s, and all my friends were buying products and fashion, and they would go to department stores and not find any jeans at the time. This was 2016, 17. And then they would go to the Vintage Twin or these overpriced vintage stores and spend upward of $300 on vintage jeans. And so I felt that there was something missing in the market, which was this incredible classic blue jean that I think there was amazing products coming out of the industry in the late 90s and early 2000s. And something, you know, the ball was dropped. So I felt very inspired to, you know, pick up that ball and continue that conversation of the American uniform, blue jeans and a white t-shirt. And so that's sort of where the journey started.
So Sonia notices something was missing in the industry, and she has this incredible idea. Maurice, how were you able to help her launch Still Here in a scrappy way with, I believe, just $20,000? What were some of the initial things that you guys invested in?
Yeah, so when I started working on Still Here with Sonia, I actually had a full-time job at a wholesale company, and I was helping Sonia to essentially figure out the nuts and bolts of production and bringing a product to market at night. So I was working a full day of work and then coming home, popping open the laptop and basically, you know, working through some of the initial challenges with her. But the money that came for the first production run was actually money that we got as gifts from our wedding. So we had gotten married in 2017. both right out of college. Sonia and I actually grew up together, so we know each other since we're children.
High school sweethearts.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I love the backstory. If only I could run a life and business partner podcast, but this is incredible. Wow. Okay. So you get married right off of college and you actually use your wedding gift for building up Still Here. Yeah. What were some of the initial things you did?
Yeah. So, well, first and foremost, Sonia had a vision and it was challenging for me to wrap my head around it, just knowing that, you know, it was going to be an expensive undertaking. And understanding what she wanted to do was very inspiring. And so for me, looking at the business from a macro perspective early on, I was just trying to help create the foundation for something small, honestly. And as we continued to build together, we found our rhythm and the momentum started to pick up. And so I had to, you know, dedicate more time and energy towards the business and really helping build some more foundation. And I didn't have experience in the clothing industry or fashion in general. And so, you know, there was a huge learning curve for me as well. And I found it to be both challenging and satisfying to do right, which took some time. I think the biggest problem we faced initially was figuring out production. And we were flying back and forth to California. You know, Sonia was jumping on red eyes and coming back the next day, you know, spending 6 hours just at a facility doing some testing. We spent a lot of time there for our first few production runs that we were doing in LA. So that was a big part of it, putting together pricing. And then because we had initially launched with a major retailer, figuring out the kinks and all of the necessary information and details required to work with a major retailer. And that was something that luckily I had some experience with from the business that I was working at, but in a completely different category, in a completely different price point, and with very different types of buyers. So that was most of what we began working on initially together.
Yeah. Building the groundwork to make sure that production and logistics can happen. While that's one part of the business, Sonia, there is this big break with how you've initially started with painting on vintage jeans to actually transitioning to Still Here. So talk to us about that experience and also how it led you to that big retailer that Maurice was hinting at.
Yes. So on Instagram in 2017, it was an exciting time to just get attention with the right people. And so we got invited to the Capsule Show in New York to paint on jeans. So someone was bringing vintage jeans and I was there just like painting these stripes that became signature to Still Here. And Maurice and I being, you know, native New Yorkers from Brooklyn, we were like, yeah, we're going to skip the line and, you know, we're just going to bring a rack of samples and pretend we bought a booth here. So I think we got married like a month prior to this. So we're like newlyweds and this business was taking off. And anyway, I was sitting there painting jeans. And by the end of the show, we actually had about 250 interested retailers that were requesting line sheets and, you know, just giving me their business card. And just there was so much excitement around what was happening with their stripes on these vintage jeans. And the owner of the Capsule Show actually came up to me and said, you know, you're the most exciting vendor here. I want to see you back here in a year from now. And I was like, okay, you know, I was naive. I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And then the night of the last day, Maurice and I received an email from Barney's New York requesting line sheets. And so being from New York, that's the greatest email that can ever come into your inbox. They at the time were the movers and shakers of fashion, which felt like across the world, honestly. And Maurice and I had our aha moment where we really were digesting that there is something here, something worth building. And we had to figure out how to do that. So we responded something like, you know, yes, working on it. We'll get back to you shortly. And we actually spent a full year in R&D figuring out how to scale this, you know, very, I would say mom and pop, you know, unscalable also business plan, which is hand-painted stripes on vintage jeans. So it's like hand-painted number one, vintage stock, which is dwindling by the moment. And so we were like in this funny place So it really took a year for us to figure out, like, hey, we actually think that the beauty in the concept here is actually in the genes. And so I spent really about 9 months with a pattern maker figuring out what I felt like was missing from the marketplace. And so there's so much detail that from a design standpoint I can speak about, but it was the first fit. It was called the Tate. What was novel about the Tate was that, number one, we were approaching the denim industry with this idea that we want to return to 100% cotton jeans. That isn't crazy. And at the time, comfort stretch was such a huge thing. So it kind of was crazy. And it makes sense that Barneys was the only one that was really interested in this idea because they were, you know, the hub of avant-garde fashion. So that was number one. And number two was, I think that there was this feeling that I always grew up with, that when you feel a pair of vintage Levi's and you just feel like they're, it's substantial and like this is going to last and you could do life in them. I really was looking for a fabric that felt that way. And then in terms of fit, there was so much just work that went into making your tush look great. And I think when it comes down to jeans, you know, you look at yourself in the mirror in the front and then you quickly turn around and there are certain elements that are undeniable to jeans. And so I really was taking all of those things into account and building something I felt was missing from the market, even just with one SKU. And then figuring out how to, you know, scale the painting. So that was all happening still at home. And so finally, after a year, responded to Barney's email with line sheets saying like, hey, like if you're still interested, we figured this thing out. And they were interested. They said, come in. We brought in our samples and they were still excited, you know, but it was kind of this Devil Wears Prada moment where like everything's black and it's kind of scary and we were shaking and everything we said felt like the wrong thing. And by the end of the meeting, they were like, great, how many units do you have? We'll take them all. And so we walked out of that meeting, had martinis, and then said like, okay, great. We have to figure out how to hand paint 250 jeans. My mom and I spent 3 months in a basement studio apartment on Canal Street, painting jeans, heat setting them, doing all the things, then, you know, tagging them, doing everything on the wholesale side, which Maurice was so tremendously helpful with on how to actually ship to a retailer like this. And we shipped to them and they sold out within a week and a half. And we actually hit their denim sell-through records on the floor. And so they were like, okay, we need more jeans. And that kind of marks the moment where Maurice and I looked at each other and we were like, okay, we're in business. We need to go to LA. We need to figure out how to scale this thing. There's something viable here and it's really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like the dream moment for so many founders, right? It's also an inflection point of, I think, stress as well. So Maurice, kind of take us through the next steps, right? You know, you have a great success with Barneys, that everything is sold out. Now you actually have to figure out how to do this on a larger scale. What are the realities of getting such a large PO?
Yeah, so it's funny because every time we had one of these great breakthrough moments, there was a challenge that was immediately following it. And so when we got that second order from Barneys, that was a larger order. I think it was 400 jeans. And like Sonia said, we flew out to LA and we met with the factory and we bought the fabric and we bought the trim and, you know, we came with the PO in our hands. Like it was just like this very, crafty moment where Sonia and I were super excited by the traction we were getting, but also recognizing that this required, you know, management that we both didn't have a lot of experience in. And that we would have to be on top of. And, you know, I was working a full-time job. And so we recognized, you know, being in business was going to be a challenge and we accepted that. But what we didn't see coming was that when we delivered the 400 jeans eventually to Barneys and, you know, wrapped the pallet ourselves in Sonia's parents' garage and did all the routing and like helped the truck driver put it on the truck from her parents' house, like literally involved in every detail, we didn't foresee that Barneys would, you know, soon after we delivered, about 3 weeks later, go bankrupt. So, yeah. So that was interesting. And we immediately had to pivot.
So you have this financial discipline that's laying a great foundation for the business. And Sonia, on top of that, you're able to build an incredible brand, one that so many top fashion editors are referencing as their favorite jean. How are you staying ahead of the curve and staying inspired to create even more for the customers that love you so much?
Well, I would say that we have a very positive and faithful view of life and especially business. I think even in moments like that, we were constantly reminding ourselves that we just don't have the full picture yet. And which was the case. We were able to break Net-a-Porter right after Barney's, before they went bankrupt. And we started getting interest because of Barney's. So it really opened up the door. And so it for us, it never really marked, you know, a bad moment in our careers. It was actually the start, because it really catapulted us to the exposure that we needed to have at that moment. You know, wholesale came to us. Net-a-Porter was interested. Browns, Farfetch. Maurice, you could speak to this part.
Yeah, so we had some traction in wholesale, and we had this great sell-through. And so I started immediately cold outreach to other major retailers, saying basically, like, here's the sell through of, you know, the product that we had on the floor at Barney's. And when they saw that, we were able to get the meetings that we were hoping for. So we were on our own, like, bouncing around to offices and, like, renting breathers just to show product to, you know, major retailers. And we were able to break Net-a-Porter, Farfetch, Browns Fashion, Neiman Marcus, Saks, you know, Harvey Nichols, Selfridges, Fred Segal. So, like, some of the greatest department stores and luxury boutiques in America and internationally. And from there, we were so excited because we started to collect, you know, a bunch of orders from retailers on this season and really go into a larger production with the factory, who was so happy to receive that big order. And we went into production, got all that product made for retailers. And when it was time to deliver the product, the retailers started to slowly reach out to us, letting us know that they couldn't accept the product because they were considering closing their warehouses because of COVID.
It's incredible to hear, because both of you view these turning points not as moments of negativity, but moments of opportunity. So I'm sure this is the start and inflection of direct-to-consumer. So talk to us about facing this new chapter of challenge, and with great success of wholesale, how do you transition and sell directly to your fans?
Well, at that point, we had to get the product out of the warehouse because it was in California and they were having restrictions very quickly. And so we shipped all the product to our apartment in Brooklyn, and we were sitting with a bunch of product in our Brooklyn apartment. And Sonia and I were looking at each other saying, what are we going to do? And we were like, OK, all these retailers are going to close. We have all this product. We basically, you know, locked up all of our available cash flow into this. And we had to be scrappy. So we looked at each other and said, it's got to be direct to consumer.
Well, the funny thing is, right at the time that we actually pitched Barney's, Maurice and I had this idea, because there's a chance Barney's does not respond to us. But we were still really excited about the business. And so we built a website on Shopify. And we put announced on the Instagram, like, website launching at 12 a.m. on this date. Meanwhile, like, 12 a.m., who's even awake? Like,
And we had like 30 followers.
It was so funny. Yeah, like, we had a couple hundred followers. Like, who cares? But, you know, we announced that our website's going to go live. And I just remember this moment so clearly, that Maurice and I, like, 12 a.m. came and the website wasn't ready. And Maurice and I were like, oh my God, you know, what are we going to do? People are waiting for the website to be ready. And we were fixing everything. And we realized we didn't name the product. And all of this is happening between like 12 a.m. and 3 a.m. And then finally at 3 a.m. it was ready to publish. And we published the website. And I just remember sitting on the bed with Maurice, like, staring at the live views. And it was just like zero. And it marked a time that Maurice and I really decided to shift the business to focus more direct to consumer and all the things that comes with that. Because obviously, you know, you can't just publish a website and expect people to find you and believe in your product. But that's how we started the website and began our journey in direct to consumer.
I love the cute backstory of like building that initial site. And it just also shows how much foresight the both of you had. So Maurice, maybe talk to us about how did you adapt the business to make sure that direct-to-consumer shipping to customers was running smoothly?
Yeah, so direct-to-consumer was definitely easier. I'll start by that. Because just when you're dealing with these major retailers, there's just a 70-page vendor guide that you have to go through, and then you deliver the product, and then there's chargebacks for things that were that were labeled the wrong way. And, you know, they just have so many regulations and guidelines that you have to follow. And with direct-to-consumer, there's just like so much more freedom to be the brand. And so we had a slow start, and we tested a lot of different ways to work with our customers. So initially, we were going out with no digital ads. It was just all organic. And so most of the traffic was being driven by organic social media posts. You know, back then it was easier to gift influencers and have them tag you and, you know, get sales from that. Now you don't see that as much or as often driving actual revenue. But back then it was a strong channel. And so we did, you know, a bunch of that, and we continued to build the following in that way. And there's some of the logistics associated with it is Sonia and I were just like picking, packing, pulling product, shipping it out ourselves. You know, we had a little postcard that we would put in every single order. A lot of times we would handwrite a note saying, thank you so much for your support. We hope you enjoy these jeans, you know, from Sonia or from Maurice or from the team. And we would throw in some goodies here and there, like a hat or whatever it might be, just like something to really give that personal touch. And it was very personal to us.
Each flash or tag in the beginning stages was numbered. So each jean was numbered. The flash or tag would be the tag that was on the back patch pocket. So like everything was hand stamped and numbered and yeah, like handwritten note and just a ton of care in each package, which I think that we felt was part of the magic in direct to consumer and something that was obviously missing when you're working with, you get the exposure when you're working with wholesale stores, but with direct to consumer, we were kind of invigorated at this concept that we could completely control the experience that the customer is having with our product.
What an incredible journey and pivot. You have a few years where you are balancing more of a direct-to-consumer model. And then fast forward a bit to 2022, you also opened the first brick-and-mortar location in New York City. Why was this so important for the business?
Yeah. So through the website, we quickly recognized the challenges of selling, like I said, 100% cotton jeans online. There was this learning curve with customers for sizing that we really couldn't hack as creative as we were getting with our size guides and communication around sizing. We were seeing that a lot of the sales that we were getting were not sticky. It was like the exchange rates were so high, and across the board in denim, like they're just higher than other categories. And we were accepting that, but at the same time, we're trying to problem solve. And we looked at each other and we were like, we're in New York. We're New Yorkers. This is the hub of commerce. This is the hub of fashion. And our consumers are walking the streets. Let's do everything we can to open a store.
Yeah. And I think the insight there was like, we were looking at the data and we were just seeing the return rates were so high on the product. And it was just like, because we were selling 100% cotton jeans and we were doing it online, and because that was novel at the time, it was like, good luck telling a woman that she's actually a size 26 when she thinks she's a size 24.
Yeah. We were also working against vanity sizing, which is just very commonplace. But with 100% cotton jeans, there's no lying. It's really just right according to spec. So I think a lot of our customers were used to vanity sizing and comfort stretch jeans. And so we had that challenge. And then there's also this concept of like, when you're a long-term fan of, let's say, frame, you know your size in frame, and then you can order online. But it felt like it was clear that we needed to give our customers an easier way to buy the brand. And so it was still COVID, and Maurice and I felt really strongly about this, and we started touring retail spaces. We were looking for about, I want to say, a year. We were looking at spaces and just, we didn't even have money to do it. But we were looking at spaces and just trying to understand the landscape. And being from New York as a consumer, it really gave us an upper hand, but we were approaching it as also like, where is our customer and which customer do we want? And so, you know, we were like, oh, do we want Nolita? Do we want Lower East Side? Do we want Bleecker Street? Like, who is she? And we ultimately found a space that we were so excited about.
It was occupied.
It was occupied. We were like, oh, we want this one.
We told the broker, we were like, if this ever becomes available, this is the one we would take. Oh. And they were just like, of course, you guys, you know, are going to be difficult like that. And lo and behold, 6 months later, it was available.
Yeah. And we got the lease in our hands and we signed it practically on the spot.
Wow.
We felt very confident about it and we signed it. I stayed up that night in the space with graph paper and a pencil, designed the whole space. The next day, met with a millworker, and we built the space in 10 days and were open for business on the 11th day.
Yeah. And we had negotiated some free rent for the build out. So the thought process there was, if we can get, you know, a month or two of free rent and we can open in 10 days, then we can make up the difference to be able to pay them rent by the time we have to pay it. Yeah.
We had no idea what kind of venture we were embarking on. And I should also say it was at the tail end of COVID. So there was just so much uncertainty in the world, especially on the retail landscape. It was a bizarre business move on our end to be taking a risk like that. But we strongly felt and still do that in the realm of direct to consumer, like one hand feeds the other in terms of online and retail. And thankfully that was what happened.
I did want to dig in a little bit on the financial piece because it is quite a large investment and a lot of founders are excited about having a retail space, but it's also quite scary. Maurice, maybe talk to us about like negotiating that buffer of free rent and also what are some checklist items to make sure like as a founder, I am actually ready to invest into retail?
Yeah, so I think just like backing it up a little bit, understanding where we were coming from, having launched with basically our savings account in product and then having the first retailer we worked with go bankrupt and, you know, not getting paid for that product, having to then launch with all these other major retailers, I had to put on, you know, a different hat and say, like, if we're not going to take on debt and we're not going to raise money to do this, then we have to figure out a way to cash flow the business. And so the insight was, these retailers have money and I can probably just get a deposit from them for the orders that they're writing. So we had these major retailers that were placing these wholesale orders, essentially financing the business for a year before we opened our retail store. So even with, you know, some of the warehouse lockdowns, we still had 50% deposits from a lot of the retailers we were working with. And so we had used that as the capital that would be used to open the first retail store. And so in the negotiation process of finding the space and, you know, really committing to it, I had a couple of non-negotiables. And the first one was that it had to be a COVID deal or else we couldn't afford to open the retail store. And we got that. Also, just having grown up in New York, we're lucky enough to have a large community of New Yorkers and, you know, so many people we know that are involved in real estate, whether it's on the brokerage side or whether it's on the ownership side or whether it's just on the tenant side. And so we were able to get a lot of advice and help and through friends and, you know, friends of the brand as well. So we had a leg up for sure coming to the market. We took a really small space, which I think was, you know, necessary considering that we were on a low budget. Our store's 350 square feet. And, you know, no one else was renting stores during that time. So I think just considering all those factors, we had the ability to have some flexibility. And so asking the landlord for free rent and being able to negotiate an option for extension and all the things that would eventually become pivotal parts of the reason why retail is profitable for us were in one way strategic and in another way being in the right place at the right time.
Incredible. Yeah, there's such great financial discipline and a foundation for the business. But I think also on top of this is also, Sonia, your continuous eye and also continuous taste in the design and also shaping the brand. I think it's something that's incredibly hard to do within fashion. So what is your kind of process for making sure you are creating what your customers are wanting?
I try to be a very aware consumer myself to see what's working on me in terms of fashion, in terms of marketing, in terms of brand storytelling. And so I think that I constantly am sharpening my eye with what I'm seeing around me and even just what was done in the past and what's happening currently. And then I find it to be incredibly inspiring to have retail and to understand our customer on that level, because we really do have the ability to study who this customer is and what she wants. And so that I think also is really insightful. I am definitely a very creative person. I don't usually, you know, I won't give myself the compliment, but I am very creative. But I think that through Still Here, I've been able to also channel my creativity in business. And I think also one hand feeds the other, and I'm able to take insights that are on the business side and really dictate and inform the creative. But there is something really exciting to me that started in 2017, which stays with me every single collection that I design and every single campaign I go in with the same concept, which is everyday dressing and the simplicity of a blue jean and white t-shirt and the American uniform. These three phrases stick with me, and they feel like they are endless inspiration for how we can continue to storytell and how we could continue to design collections that feel on brand and feel really fresh. What I think is also a component here is that, you know, like I said, I'm very close to the customer, but the customer feels very close to us as well. They feel very connected to the brand, like they're watching us grow, and that they have a close connection to us and that we listen to them. And so I think that at a time, Maurice and I began our careers at this time of direct-to-consumer companies blowing up. And, you know, some of them are billion-dollar companies now and some of them are not around anymore. But it was an interesting time to be watching founders build businesses that, like, let's say Outdoor Voices. It was such an incredible company to watch come up, and the product was incredible and the storytelling was incredible. Everything about it was inspiring. I think that with Still Here, everything was really perfect about it. I think with Still Here, it's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum, which is that we're pretty vulnerable with how we've started and all the journey that we've taken up until now. We're constantly evolving, but within the realm of blue jeans and a white t-shirt. So it really does give us an exciting confines to always stick within. I take a lot of personal inspiration from seeing generationally how many customers we can dress. The obvious customer that we have is she's in her late 20s, early 30s. She's, you know, starting to make money on her own and she has her own taste. And then she brings her mom into the store, and because her mom really likes her jeans, and now her mom becomes our customer and her mom brings her mom. And so we see this generational customer that is incredibly inspiring. So I think that that's also just been an investment in knowing that we're on the right track with kind of the storytelling that we're doing on the design end and on the marketing end. And on the marketing end, we find that there is a really special component to, you know, if we give a customer all these elements of pieces of, you know, basic tops and jeans that make them feel and look good, there's this added component of how are you going to style them? And that really is what the customer brings to the table. And we really like to be inspiring our customer to be styling the pieces in their wardrobe, and it really we're giving them essential pieces in their wardrobe that then they just bring to life with how they style it.
Yeah, I mean, by being closet staples, I think you are also a staple in so many customers' lives. And that's why they return to Still Here. And they also bring their family members to Still Here as well. I mean, you know, reflection point, Sonia, with the incredible brand and design. Maurice, on just the logistics operations side, it's incredible to understand that this business is still bootstrapped, still owned by the two of you, and you were able to scale it to 8 figures. I think that is something a lot of our listeners and fellow founders would hope to achieve. What are some kind of like basic things that you wish you can share with founders that they need to keep in mind to make sure that they have a good financial foundation to scale in this way?
I think it's important to understand what you're building, first and foremost. There's different ways to build a business, and there's different types of companies and brands. Sometimes people are building to sell. Sometimes people are building because they're inspired by something that doesn't exist in the world, and they just want to bring that to life for themselves, for their friends. You know, sometimes people are building their family business that will be around for generations. And I think first and foremost, it's important to know what you're building and why you're building it. And I think that from there, it can inform the strategy from a financial perspective. And so for us, like I said earlier, when we were building the initial foundation of this business, it was built to be a small brand. It was built to be a side hustle. It was built to be a passion project. And as we started to understand that there was a consumer for this product that was beyond what we had expected, the strategy, of course, changed. But we realized that we had to invest more. And continuing to invest more of our own time, energy, and money eventually ended up being, paying off. And so the way that we initially thought about the business, given, you know, where we were and what we were seeing, was that everything we did initially had to have a return on investment, or else we wouldn't be around in 6 months. And so all the decisions we were making, they couldn't just be for brand or for marketing purposes. They had to have an amountable return on investment. So if we were spending $1,000, that had to come back as $2,000 or more. And so that led us to think very strategically as to what opportunities we should be executing on. And it also made us think very tightly about the cash flow and the way, you know, the opportunity that the business would have over a long period of time to stay self-funded. And I think because we were thinking in that way for such a long period of time, just ROI focused with everything we were doing, we got to a point where the business was essentially built to be a cash flowing machine, in that the revenue monthly had to cover the nut entirely. And it had to cover multiple months in the case that we didn't sell another product for 2 to 3 months, which obviously is an uncommon way of thinking about the business that early on. And so just, you know, years of that put us in a position where we opened retail because we needed immediate funds. And so the retail store allowed us to be able to make sales every day on the product.
There were no returns at retail.
Sticky sales, yeah. And one of the things that we asked in our initial conversations with the brokers, you know, when looking at the retail spaces, is how many people are going to walk into the store every day? How many, you know, you guys deal with many brands. How many jeans do you think we'll sell a day? And, you know, the broker, being a close friend of mine, was like, I think you'll sell at least one pair of jeans a day. And I was like, okay.
Safe estimate.
Yeah. Cool. I was like, okay, that's a start. Like right now we're selling 0.5 jeans a day on our website, you know, average. And so just looking at it in that way, and understanding that we needed to have a constant flow of cash into the business in order to survive another day was what got us to this state. And so that bleeds, you know, that bleeds down into every part of the business. It continues to be a big part of the ethos. Now we will make investments that, you know, we won't see ROI on for 12 to 16 to 18 months sometimes even, right? Things like inventory, building out new websites, marketing expenses. But net-net, looking at each department and each part of the business, whether it's retail as a sales channel or whether it's online or wholesale, each one of those sales channels has to be profitable. And at the end of the day, that leads the business to be highly profitable as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's truly incredible and fascinating to hear both of your perspectives on building this brand that has been lovable for so many years and also having built the financial discipline for such an incredible financial foundation. To close out the show, I would love to hear from the both of you on your perspective for what growth and expansion would look like for Still Here.
So we now have two retail stores, our Nolita store downtown and our Madison store on the Upper East Side. Retail is a sales channel for us that we see a lot of potential growth and one that we're most excited by, I would say. We are opening our store in Brooklyn in August. So about 4 weeks from now, we'll have our third store.
And third baby. Same due date.
Oh my goodness. How exciting.
Yeah. And so three stores, three babies. We are eyeing retail expansion outside of New York, which is exciting to us as well. And we are building a new website with a great team. We're excited to put live. Sonia just can speak to further, you know, all the product that she just reshot. Some of the different areas in the D2C side that we are investing to hopefully see further growth online as well. Wholesale is another channel of ours that we're eyeing a lot of growth on. So we actually are represented by a sales agency in New York City. And we now sell about 120, 125 boutiques and specialty stores in America. We have very strategic major retail placements. So we pulled back in a big way from wholesale partners where we weren't seeing it being a strategic placement or a mutually beneficial relationship. Now we work with about three or four major retailers, and you know, the rest of the stores we work with are mom and pop, stores throughout America. And yeah, so that's like most of the growth that we're eyeing. We've been investing a lot in digital marketing, content creation, digital strategy, gifting. Sonia can speak more to that.
Yeah, I think the growth of the business feels very natural in as we expand retail. I think Maurice and I both feel that there is so much excitement and an amazing amount of voice that the brand can have on the retail level when done correctly, and when, you know, the power of choosing the right space in the right area. And I think that as we continue to expand retail, I'm excited to look at each space as its own destination. And we look at retail also as with hospitality in mind, and how can we create these spaces that really invest in the brand and allow for a customer, even if they walk out with no jeans, they leave with a beautiful sentiment. So I think that retail expansion is definitely on the horizon and an exciting one for us. And being the creative director and designer, I will always be advocating for a good product. I believe that businesses with that are product first and that really believe and can get behind their products will always succeed. There were times that in the many, many times in the business where Maurice and I would be just banging our heads against the wall saying, like, we're doing everything here. Why isn't it working? And I think those are the exciting times in business because you continue. You know, you wake up the next day and you're continuing, and you have that drive and you have that fight and courage to continue. And I personally believe that that comes from believing in your product. So I am very thrilled constantly about continuing to put out good jeans. I still feel like there is this white space in the market that we didn't capture entirely yet. We are really big in New York, and we're pretty big on the coastal in the coastal cities, but we have the whole world to convince that we have great jeans. And there was a really, I think, the most inspiring part of my year was actually going to London and having this feeling that I had in 2017, which was like, oh my God, they don't know Jean's here. They need us. I felt like they need Still Here. And I think it's moments like that, that, you know, you feel like a kid in a candy store, that there's just all of this opportunity for your business to grow in that direction. So I think on the horizon is also just international growth and really owning this idea of the American uniform and everyday dressing and really distilling those concepts down to these bare bones. I think in 10, 15 years, it's my little secret, but I will be so happy to see a vintage Still Here jean and see how our jeans wear. So I have big goals there. But I think we have a lot more jeans to sell.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's exciting. And I'm so glad we got to chat with the both of you and understand how Still Here is still growing. Thank you both, Maurice and Sonia, for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Sonia and Maurice Mosseri, founders of Still Here. Shopify Masters is produced by Alicia Clark and Gogo Zoger. Our engineers are Miku Betlam and Matt Schwartz. And I'm your host, Shuang Esther Shan. Come back every Tuesday and Thursday for brand new episodes. Subscribe so you never miss it. And check us out on YouTube for video interviews. Until next time.